Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Philosophy with Dr. McDonald. In this episode, I'll be reading and discussing the section, The Second Dance Song, in Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra. So in this section, we have a nice discussion between Zarathustra and life. And I also have a nice wee brief discussion of the film Mother from 2017, starring Jennifer Lawrence, and how it fits into the section. So let's get started. The Second Dance Song, Section 1. Lately I gazed into your eyes, O life. I saw gold glittering in your eyes of night. My heart stood still with delight. I saw a golden bark glittering upon dark waters, a submerging, surging, re-emerging, golden, tossing bark. At my feet, my dancing mad feet, you threw a glance, a laughing, questioning, melting, tossing glance. Twice only did you raise your castanets in your little hands, then my feet were already tossing in a mad dance. My heels raised themselves, my toes listened for what you should propose, for the dancer wears his ears and his toes. I sprang to your side, then you led back from my spring, towards me the tongues of your fleeing, flying hair came hissing. Away from you and from your serpents did I retire, and then at once, half turned, your eyes full of desire. With your crooked smile, you teach me crooked ways. Upon crooked ways, my feet learn guile. I fear you when you are near. I love you when you are far. Your fleeing allures me. Your seeking secures me. I suffer, but for you, what would I not gladly endure? For you whose coldness inflames, whose hatred seduces, whose flight constrains, whose mockery induces, who would not hate you? Great woman who binds us, enwinds us, seduces us, seeks us, finds us, who would not love you, you innocent, impatient, wind-swift, child-eyed sinner? Where now do you take me, you unruly paragon? And again, you forsake me, you sweet, ungrateful tomboy. I dance after you, I follow you even when only the slightest traces of you linger. Where are you now? Give me your hand, or just a finger. Here are caves and thickets, we shall go astray. Stop, stand still, do you not see owls and bats flitting away? Would you befoul me, you bat, you owl? Where are we? Did you learn from the dog thus to bark and howl? Your little white teeth, you sweetly bare at me, from under your curly little mane, your wicked eyes stare at me. This is a dance over dale and hill. I am the hunter. Will you be my hound, or will you be my kill? Now stand beside me, and quickly, you wicked rover. Now spring up and across. Help! In springing, I myself have gone over. Oh, see me lying, you wanton companion, and begging for grace. I long to follow you in a sweeter cause. Love's chase through flowery bushes, still and dim, or there beside the lake where goldfishes dance and swim. Are you now weary? There yonder are sheep and evening. Let us end our pursuit. Is it not sweet to sleep when the shepherd plays his flute? Are you so very weary? I will carry you there. Just let your arms sink. And if you are thirsty, I should have something. But you would not like it to drink. Oh, this accursed, nimble, supple snake and slippery witch. Where have you gone? But on my face, I feel from your hand two spots. And blotches itch. I am truly weary of being your shepherd, always sheepish and meek, you witch. If I have hitherto sung for you, now for me you shall shriek. To the rhythm of my whip you shall shriek and trot. Did I forget my whip? I did not. And so kicking us off in the start of this section, we have Zarathustra dancing and trying to find this woman, and she keeps on going out of his grasp, and she keeps on going away, and he is going to try and find her each given time. And we have this whole relation back into the first dance song then, where we have life itself described as this beautiful, great woman. And so then in the second dance song, we have this woman creep back in. And a good metaphor here is one from 1950s film noir movies, where you have female characters, one in particular called a femme fatale. And the femme fatale is precisely that female character that'll try and lead the protagonist astray and use him in order for her to accomplish her own goals in a very much cunning and deceiving and conniving sort of way, with always the enticement of sex spliced into the mix. So it's always in the sense of, if you do something for me, I'll do something for you. Scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. And you get that through several different film noirs, which is in itself a fantastic genre. But then we come back into the Nietzsche and we can say, well, this is what we have life portrayed as, not precisely this pure thing, but rather like a femme fatale that then leads us astray. And then we have that nice relation into desire that's going on at the same time here, where the more we indulge in our desires, the more we're led astray. And so we have that sort of nice relation back into organized religion that keeps on popping up in these past sections, where you can say, well, if you continually indulge in your need for food, then that's going to be a bad thing for you health-wise and lead to obesity problems. But it's always that temptation of wanting something else to eat. And, ooh, what about that chocolate? Or, ooh, what about that big bag of crisps or potato chips and so on? What does all that indulgence in the first place do is allow us to have that sense of pleasure at the same time. And so what's interesting then is that little line at the end where it's to say, well, you've led me astray, but I'm gonna now take control back for myself, and I'm gonna bring my whip with me this time, because now you're gonna listen to me. And it's that interesting relation again back into desire. We can say, well, it's that point you can have that sense of control, taking the whip for yourself, basically, and saying, no, I'm not going to have that indulgence now. No, I'm not going to need that massive packet of crisps. Actually, I could go have an apple instead. No. On the other hand, there is an interesting relation into nature that's going on at the same time here, where you can have man's romanticism and indulgence with nature in a very much idealistic way. Oh, that beautiful, serene landscape, the trees, the mountains, and so on. And you get kind of that in Rousseau when you read his Confessions and so forth, when you're having this fantastic indulgence with nature. But on the other hand, there's the irony to that, to say, well, in the midst of all that ideality and picturesqueness that's been built up, you forget about the actual horror and just material, realistic aspects of nature itself, that it's not just this serene landscape at all. And you have that in the whole little bit there, but on my face I feel from your hand two spots and blotches itch. So it's that whole point to say, well, within all that ideality, we have the challenge to that through the actual reality of it all, because nature's not this thing that would look good in a picture frame that you can hang up in your living room, but rather it's also this thing that can cause us to be in ill health, or because of all the different natural occurrences, natural disasters in the world, those are not picturesque or nice or lovely at all. And then what's so interesting just about that whole idea of cracking the whip and getting control is this whole relationship with man and nature that sort of happens, where you precisely have man trying to order and control nature and trying to determine it. So a good way to think about that is a garden that's completely ordered and structured, for instance, where you would have flowers arranged in a certain way. And that's all the ways in which you can then build upon just how the human species likes to crack the whip at nature, tries to get control over nature, and therefore we always forget about the very powers and force of nature itself at the same time, because we're so much just enticed with that ideality, and that we'd rather use nature as a force for ourselves and for the human species, and for everything to be narrowed down very much just to serve our own purposes, rather than to serve the best for animals or for the world itself. So that's what's an interesting sort of takeaway you can have from this at the same time, to say, well, this whole idea of cracking the whip, man's control over nature, we're trying to funnel everything down to the human species, but what about the environment itself? What about the animal species? So a good example of that would be the destruction of the rainforest by the planting of the whole bio oil trees and so forth that's there. And of course, there's the whole irony amongst that as well, that you're trying to protect the environment by creating bio oil, but you're destroying the environment at the same time in order to produce it. And then not only that, you're also destroying the habitats of the animals at the same time. And so from that example, you could say, well, not only do we have the irony at work, but we also have a particular example where the human species tries to funnel everything down to make sure it always works best for us. And then who cares about whatever habitats that's there? As long as we're okay, who should care about that? And that's, of course, what one of the big problems is of that. And of course, for the just environment side of things, easy example of that is, of course, the problems of global warming. And what can we therefore do as a species to try and stop it? And so, continuing on to section 2, where we have life's response to Zarathustra. Then life answered me thus, keeping her gentle ears closed. O Zarathustra, don't crack your whip so terribly. You should surely know, noise kills thought, and now such tender thoughts are coming to me. We are both proper ne'er-do-wells and ne'er-do-ills. Beyond good and evil did we discover our island and our green meadow, we two alone. Therefore we must love one another. And even if we do not love one another from the very heart, do people have to dislike one another if they do not love one another from the very heart? And that I love you, and often love you too well, that I know. And the reason is that I am jealous of your wisdom. Ah, this crazy old fool, wisdom. If your wisdom should one day desert you, alas, then my love would quickly desert you too. Thereupon life gazed thoughtfully behind her and around her and said gently, O Zarathustra, you are not faithful enough to me. You do not love me nearly as much as you say. I know you are thinking of leaving me soon. There is an old, heavy, heavy booming bell. It booms out at night up to your cave. When you hear this bell, beat the hour at midnight. Then you think between 1 and 12. You think, O Zarathustra, I know it, you think of leaving me soon. Yes, I answered hesitantly. But you also know, and I said something into her ear, in the midst of her tangled, yellow, foolish locks. You know that, O Zarathustra? No one knows that. And we gazed at one another and looked out at the green meadow over which the cooling evening was spreading, and wept together. But then life was dearer to me than all my wisdom had ever been. Thus spoke Zarathustra. Life's reply back to Zarathustra, don't crack your whip at me so terribly. We should love one another. And it's such a great line. And even if we do not love one another from the very heart, do people have to dislike one another if they do not love one another from the very heart? And it's that whole point that even though that we may be at complete opposite ends of the scale, completely different points of view, there's no reason why we shouldn't get along and we shouldn't ultimately love one another in the midst of all that. But that's not to then just sweep under the carpet all those differences, of course, but it's to say, well, even though we have our differences, at the same time, we should still get absolutely along with one another. Because it goes into that whole point about, well, what is the ideal companion? It's not just simply a clone. And we've talked about this in previous episodes as well. We never want just simply us replicated, because we want the companion that's also different, has different opinions. And that's the whole point about loving another person, is to also love their differences at the same time. And then after this, we have the whole point that life makes to Zarathustra, you're gonna leave me soon. And what exactly is Zarathustra thinking of leaving life for is eternity, and this whole notion of eternity. But not in a traditional sense of it, rather that whole relation into the eternal return. But we don't get that until the next section, the Seven Seals, where it talks all about the eternal return again. And in this section, we have a nice relation into wisdom. Life telling Zarathustra, ah, I love your wisdom. And what exactly is this getting at in a deeper sense, of course, is because all of humanity's knowledge, and precisely what we deem as wise in the first place, is all deemed through our analysis and study of the world and nature. And so you can go into all the different sciences, and Nietzsche affirming here just all those different scientific approaches that we have, because regardless what field you go into, you'll have precisely that really intimate, nice, close analysis with the world. Botany, for example, and the study of plants and flowers and so on, or geology and rocks and so on and so on and so on. All those different lovely, all the lovely relationship we have with the analysis, study, and understanding the world itself. And nicely, life saying, oh, I'm so jealous of your wisdom. But then at the end, we have Zarathustra say the line, or at least think the line, to himself, life was dearer to me than all my wisdom had ever been. What a fantastic line that is. Because we have the lovely back and forth there, because Zarathustra is saying, well, even though that I have this wisdom that I've gained from the world, that actually life itself was more precious to me than knowledge. And there's something just really beautiful about that, to say, well, it doesn't matter about knowledge in the first place, that actually just life and living is so much more valuable than knowledge and the pursuit of knowledge, and to be wise. There's a nice sort of subtle criticism of philosophy here that's going on to say, well, what does philosophy at its core want to do is build all these metaphysical structures, things that will organize and structure knowledge and enable everybody to become a much more wiser individual. Nietzsche's taking the opposite route of that to say, well, what is all knowledge based upon in the first place? Very much so intimate analysis of the world, where Nietzsche has that nice relation to Aristotle, because Aristotle's very much in the same line of argument that our knowledge comes with that analysis of the world, and that wisdom itself comes from all that. But also, sort of against Aristotle here, because Aristotle still goes for metaphysics in order to understand why things work in the world, Aristotle says we still need metaphysics. But here we see Nietzsche taking a sort of drastic turn away from traditional philosophy again to say, well, you can have all the wisdom that you'd like, but what is the thing that everybody should hold dear and applaud is just life itself and the act of living. And that's the thing that should give everybody joy. And that is what gives us pleasure. And interestingly enough, from all that, that then has a knock-on effect of how knowledge is formed in the first place, and what should we go for, what should we pursue, and also how ethical models are built up as well. So we can see from all this, you could say, well, life's saying, oh, I love your wisdom. And Nietzsche's saying, well, I love you, life, much more than I love all my wisdom. So we have that nice contrast. We also have that nice relation back into psychology at the same time, and the psychological makeup of someone's life will therefore affect how they're going to think and what they're going to argue and their whole outlook. Rounding off then, we have the bell ringing in section 3. 1. O man, attend. 2. What does deep midnight's voice contend? 3. I slept my sleep. 4. And now awake at dreaming's end. 5. The world is deep. 6. Deeper than day can comprehend. 7. Deep is its woe. 8. Joy deeper than heart's agony. 9. Woe says fade and go. 10. But all joy wants eternity. 11. Wants deep, deep, deep eternity. 12. So the main thing that we get out of section 3 then, the world is deep, deep is its woe, and that joy is much deeper than heart's agony, and joy wants eternity. And just so we can then go into the whole aspect, the world is deep, so it's not simply just an understanding on the surface level of things. Deep is its woe, but then all the sadness and so forth can go away because joy is deeper than that, because joy wants eternity. So we want happiness and pleasure to be everlasting. And it makes then that move from life into eternity then, where we have not only the loving of life, but at the same time wanting joy itself to be everlasting and return back to us. And that's where we have that nice sense coming into the next section for the eternal return. We want happiness to return. We want the pleasure to return. And so a good movie for this section, I thought, was Mother from 2017, starring Jennifer Lawrence. And here's a quick synopsis as well from Google. A young woman spends her days renovating the Victorian mansion that she lives in with her husband in the countryside. When a stranger knocks on the door one night, he becomes an unexpected guest in their home. Later, his wife and two children also arrive to make themselves welcome. Terror soon strikes when the beleaguered wife tries to figure out why her husband is so seemingly friendly and accommodating to everyone but her. And so, it's a psychological horror film, and it's definitely a difficult movie to try and sit through. But on the surface level, we have all that going on with the plot. But on a deeper level, what exactly is going on? And that's what's interesting when we have this relation into the section for Nietzsche. So, we have Jennifer Lawrence then as the wife. But what the deep thing that's going on is that her husband represents humanity and Jennifer Lawrence represents Mother Nature. And so what happens is that her husband becomes so sort of indulgent in his own quest for fame and power and has this cult that sort of lives in the house eventually as well. And that all what Jennifer Lawrence is, of course, is wanting to just live just a life with her husband, but she doesn't get to have that whatsoever. And so what then happens is horrible stuff, because it's a horror movie, of course. And at the end of it all, we're really left with a message of, well, isn't humanity just horrible in their own pursuit of power, wealth, fame, because we narrow everything down just to us all the time, focus on what we can get, what we want, and we don't care about nature at all. And that we just use and abuse everything that just nature gives to us. We don't love it in any given way. And it's all just for the pursuit of wealth and power and fame, you could say, well, at least in the movie. And then what's so interesting as well is that at the very end of the movie, we have this sort of cyclical process then occur again, where the husband has that moment of complete regret for what he's done and tries to amend all the different horrible things that he's done, and tries to basically make up with Jennifer Lawrence at the end of the movie. But then we have, of course, that cycle at the very end where it starts almost straight back from the start of the movie, is the same as the end and vice versa. So there's that really deep point to say, well, we have such a vicious cyclical relationship with nature where it happens progressively over and over and over again. And that's what's so good about how it fits into the Nietzsche as well, because this is one way in which we can start to get into the deep aspects of this section when we think about that cyclical process and how we treat nature as a human species and all the different problems that then emerge out of that. And exactly how can we try and resolve those problems? How can we then try and think about the environment or think about animals and so on? But also there's that sort of irony, because it's a cyclical process, it's going to sort of happen again and again and again. So at the same time of trying to resolve those problems, it's like those problems are going to return back equally. So it's not like to say just because someone temporarily does something, that's not going to be good enough, because it's always going to come back. These are problems that are always going to need to be resolved. So that wraps up this episode. In the next episode, we'll be continuing on with the last section in part 3 of Zarathustra, the Seven Seals developing out the relation again into the Eternal Return. Many thanks for listening to the episode. I hope you enjoyed my discussion of the section, the second dance song in Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Feel free to check out my Patreon page at patreon.com/dissectingphilosophy. Also, feel free to tip me a coffee at ko-fi.com/dissectingphilosophy. You can also give me an email at my address, dissectingphilosophy@gmail.com, and I can be also found on Twitter at IAmARubberMan. Many thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me next time.